Good morning and welcome to Sports Interview with Anne Liguori on this Saturday morning, September 12, 2020. Hope you're having a good weekend so far. I'm sure a reflective one with the 19th anniversary of 9/11. And boy, it is just, that's a tough one for everybody, right? It's a very, very tough day. And my heart goes out to anybody who lost loved ones, and our country really changed after that, and our world changed and continues to change. But our country is resilient. We are strong. We all were united and worked together in our grief and in our sadness and anger after 9/11. And we must remember as a country that we can all get together and work hard to continue to make this country the best we can make it. I'm glad you can join me where I am every Saturday morning from 7 to 8. And you can hear us live online at WLIW.org. And each show is archived on my website at AnneLiguori.com. and distributed on my podcast. And the U.S. Open Tennis Championship, boy, the final weekend with the women's final later this afternoon, the men's final on Sunday. We have the U.S. Open Golf Championship taking place this coming Thursday through next Sunday at Wingfoot in Westchester. Of course, the NFL season has started, the NBA playoffs, the NHL, Major League Baseball, everything is going on at the same time. So it's a busy, busy September, and of course, school is back in session, and everything's happening. So I hope you're managing it all and staying well and trying to at least enjoy some sports. This morning, the great Hal Irwin will join us in the second half of the show. What a career Hal Irwin has had in golf, winning 3 U.S. Open titles, 20 PGA Tour titles, 45 senior tour victories, 5 Ryder Cups. He was on 5 Ryder Cup teams, captain of the first U.S. President's Cup team, Hall of Famer. The guy has won on all 6 continents. I mean, there is very little he hasn't done in golf. And with the U.S. Open taking place at Wingfoot, who better to have a conversation with about his legendary win there back in 1974? What became known as the massacre at Wingfoot. So Hal Irwin will join us. He, you know, that U.S. Open at Wingfoot in 1974 was just one of his, the first of his 3 U.S. Open victories. And he won that with a score of 7 over par. That's the second highest winning score in relation to par of any U.S. Open since 1945. The course conditions at Wingfoot he described as brutal. And so we talk a little bit about his memories of winning that 1974 U.S. Open. And, of course, we talk about some of the players who he thinks may be favored to win this coming week. He also, won his 3rd U.S. Open in 1985, becoming the oldest U.S. Open champion at the age of 45. So a lot of milestones, whether it was with the score 7 over in 74 or with his age, 45 years of age in 85. He beat Mike Donald in an 18-hole Monday playoff. He won the title with a birdie on that first sudden-death playoff hole, and it actually was the first tournament he had won in like 5 years. So we'll talk to Hal Irwin and get his recollections and his insight. Hal Irwin is also involved in an exciting new multi-channel digital platform that is going to be called Keeler 1930 that will become the authoritative tribute and voice of golf's legendary players today. So we'll talk to him about that as well. And in the first half of the show, I'll replay a conversation I had with former tennis professional Marty Fish, who is quite an accomplished golfer. And he actually became the first tennis player to win the American Century Championship, the great celebrity golf event that they do every year. NBC has every year in Lake Tahoe in July. So Marty has an interesting take on what he brings from his tennis game to golf and vice versa. And he's a really great golfer, which is rare to be that superior in two sports like that. Just incredible, incredibly talented. All right. I've been covering tennis, as many of you know, the U.S. Open, and I can't tell you how entertaining and amazing the women's semifinals were on Thursday evening. It was riveting television for 5.5 hours. First, Naomi Osaka. She beat the 25-year-old American Jen Brady in three sets. The scores were amazing, 7-6, 3-6, 6-3 for Naomi. Perhaps the last two sets not indicative of just how close the match really was. Brady, oh my gosh, just serving incredibly well. Just two incredible athletes hitting the heck out of the ball, serving great. You know, this Jennifer Brady, I can't speak more highly of. I mean, she just has such a bright future. She should win some Grand Slam titles if she can stay healthy. This semifinal was her first Grand Slam semifinal ever. She turned pro several years ago. She decided to go the college route, which a lot of players today, pros, skip the whole, you know, academic route. They go right into the pros at a very early age. But she spent 2 years at UCLA. She was an All-American there. And then I read where this past winter she went to Germany to work with a physiotherapist, really, you know, increase her stamina and strength. And she worked with her coach. And the improvement is off the charts. I mean, she's just playing incredibly well. And what a bright future Jen Brady has. And, of course, Naomi Osaka, who won the U.S. Open back in 2018, over Serena Williams. Osaka is just so calm and so composed, and yet hits the heck out of the ball as well. Just incredible athletes. So that semifinal was amazing. And then you had Victoria Azarenka of Belarus. She went out and played the legendary Serena Williams, who, of course, is pursuing a record-tying 24th Grand Slam title. And Serena's now been pursuing this for a long time, I think since 2017, the 24th. And Azarenka has just reemerged after taking a long time off. She had a son. She was actually in a custody battle over her son, and she almost quit tennis. And then I read when the pandemic started around March, Azarenka decided she would go for it again with an inspiring kind of new attitude and confidence. And at this event, she basically steamrolled through, you know, every round to get to the semis. And it looked like she was going to get wiped off the court in the first set. Serena took that first set 6-1. Serena just came out stronger and faster than I've seen her the whole championship, because she dropped the first set in a couple of her previous rounds before she was able to turn around and win in three. But Azarenka shook off the nerves, settled in, kept her energy up, and she was able to go out there and knock Serena out of this championship in three sets, 1-6, 6-3, 6-3. It was only the fifth time in 23 career matches that Victoria Azarenka was able to beat Serena Williams, and two of those matches were in the U.S. Open Finals, where Azarenka lost to Serena in 2012 and won in 2013. So we're going to have Victoria Azarenka against Naomi Osaka in this afternoon's women's final of the U.S. Open. And this match later on today should be a most compelling final, as I've never seen Azarenka play this well over the course of the entire championship. And she's hitting the Jesus out of the ball. And Naomi is hitting it just as hard. And Naomi's very smart and calm, as I said. So it will be interesting. It will be like a chess match to see who will prevail. I think, obviously, they both hit the ball as hard as can be. They are both serving extremely well. So it will really be, you know, whoever can come out and win the key points and play smart. Osaka owns a 2-1 edge over Azarenka. They were set to meet 2 weeks ago in the Western and Southern Open final, but Osaka withdrew with a left thigh injury. She still has that thigh wrapped, so we'll have to keep a look you know, on that as well. Hopefully that won't hinder her. But the women's final this afternoon, 4 p.m. on ESPN, it is going to be a doozy, I guarantee you. And at the time of this taping, the men's semis hadn't started yet, but the four guys playing in the semifinals have never won a major title yet. So these guys will become one of the these four guys will become a major champion for the first time ever in Sunday's U.S. Open men's final. The semifinals on Friday, you have Pablo Carreño Busta, the 20th seed from Spain. He's the one that advanced after only playing 11 games in the first set against Novak Djokovic, who was up a break 6-5 when they threw Novak Djokovic out of the championship. More on that in a second. But you have Busta playing Alexander Zverev of Germany, the 5th seed. And then you have 3rd seed Daniil Medvedev of Russia against the 2nd seed Dominic Thiem of Austria. Now, Medvedev was a finalist last year at the U.S. Open, but it's just they're all playing so extremely well. So the men's semis will be any one of these four guys is capable of winning the U.S. Open men's title. And when top seed and favorite to win, Novak Djokovic was defaulted from the championship last Sunday for striking a ball in anger to the end of the court, which unintentionally hit a lines judge. He was basically thrown out of the U.S. Open. The draw became wide open and set the stage for a brand new major champion in the men's. For the past 13 majors, one of the big three won the major title, whether it was Djokovic or Rafael Nadal or Roger Federer. So this could be the beginning of a new era. We'll see. But hopefully Djokovic can shake off the disappointment of being defaulted. Everybody has their own opinion. I personally think the rule is too harsh. I think nobody should lose their temper. But when you if you saw the footage, and I was watching it live, he didn't hit the ball that hard. It just unluckily hit this lines judge. She's okay, thank goodness. And I know a rule is a rule, but they, if it hits somebody, you're out. And obviously there are different scenarios though. When Roger Federer accidentally hit a ball boy at the Australian Open, I think it was 2017. They laughed about it. They did not kick Roger Federer out of that Australian Open. So it's inconsistent, depending on various cases. But I just thought it was too extreme. I mean, Novak Djokovic came all the way from Europe to play in the U.S. Open when, many of the top players in the men's and women's draw did not want to travel. They did not come. Roger Federer did not come. He has a knee injury. Rafael Nadal decided not to travel, saving himself for the French Open, which begins at the end of September. So I just thought it was too extreme under the circumstances, and they could have, docked a set, given, a game and the set to his opponent or fined him a lot of money, whatever. But to kick the top seed out of this championship in a pandemic age like this, I just thought was extreme. All right, let's move on to golf. Two-time major champion John Daly made a concerning announcement on the Golf Channel revealing that he has bladder cancer. He said he underwent a procedure to have the cancer removed, but was told there's a good chance that it will reoccur. He said his urologist said that there's an 85% chance it comes back. So I've got to go back and see him in 3 months. They will probably have to cut it out again. So we wish John Daly all the best. Hopefully they got all the cancer. He withdrew last month from the PGA Tour Champions event at the Charles Schwab Series Tournament in Missouri and said he had been experiencing back pain and kidney stones. So I guess those are some of the symptoms. All right, in the NFL, the Kansas City Chiefs began their title defense with a 34-20 win over the Texans this past Thursday night, with Patrick Mahomes effortlessly looking and leading the Chiefs, throwing for 211 yards and 3 touchdowns. Are you ready for some football, ladies and gentlemen? Tomorrow, the New York Jets will be in Buffalo, 1 p.m. on CBS, and on Monday night, the Giants will host the Pittsburgh Steelers. That should be fun. ESPN. In the NBA, the Lakers have a 3-1 lead over the Houston Rockets. In the Western semifinals, Game 5 is today. And last but not least, I like the fact that the Nets hired Steve Nash as the coach. 2-time MVP, point guard. He has a relationship with Nets stars Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving, point guards, are floor leaders. And look, you have Isaiah Thomas, you have Magic Johnson, Doc Rivers, Mark Jackson, Jason Kidd. These guys were all coaches and former point guards. And, you know, they're really connected to the players. They know their X's and O's. I think it's a great move. Somewhat controversial for many, but he's going to be great, I think, for the Nets. All right. That's my take. And we'll be back with Marty Fish in the first segment and then Hale Irwin. Sports Interview with Ann Liguori is brought to you by Peak Vision Sunglasses, Zero Distortion, and patented dual zone lens technology. Learn more at Peak Vision, peakvision.com. And Sports Interview with Ann Liguori is brought to you by Dune Jewelry and the New Hamptons Rope Collection. Savor the memories with sand from your favorite beach or golf course in timeless pieces for men and women. That's Dune, D-U-N-E, jewelry.com. Welcome back. My guest is Marty Fish, professional tennis player, hard court specialist, six-time winner on tour, and his highest ranking was seventh in the world, and current Davis Cup captain for Team USA. Marty, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Ann.
Now, I know you're playing in the American Century Championship coming up in July, and it's a great event. A lot of different celebrities like yourself vying in the pressure-packed world of golf. And so I understand you've come in second three times at the American Century Championship?
I have too many times to count, to be honest. It's a really, really fun week. Probably one of the most fun weeks outside of sort of work. And you mentioned the Davis Cup. That's a dream job of mine, the Davis Cup captain. So outside of that kind of stuff, certainly the best week of the year, one of the best weeks of the year to look forward to going and meeting everyone and seeing everyone, not really meeting everyone anymore because I'm such a big sports fan. So initially, when you go, your worlds would never collide with the Steph Currys and the Aaron Rodgers sort of over time. And so, getting to go and again, being such a big sports fan, it's fun to meet and then become friends with those guys and play a lot of golf together and over the years. And so it's truly a blast.
Well, I know Mark Mulder won two or three straight years. Then Tony Romo mm-hmm. kind of took over. He's the two-time defending champion. So how are you coming in second to these guys? Marty, come on.
They're really good players. They're really good golfers, first of all. If we want to get down into the details of it, I am a lefty, and I play a right-to-left cut. With almost every shot, every single hole at Edgewood, which is a beautiful course, is right to left. Almost the exact opposite way. So for me, the course doesn't set up incredibly well, which is fine. But that's one sort of deep end reason why I haven't played my best there. And then those guys are really good. You know, Tony plays a ton of golf. He works on his game. I think he's at least trying to make the move to play some more professional events. And John Smoltz is one who's played some professional events as well on the PGA and the Champions Tour for him. And and Mark Mulder has also gotten a sponsor's exemption into a PGA event. So, I mean, these guys are, and they hold their own. They're not, they're not making the cut, but they're not finishing last. So they're good players to try and beat. And, over 3 days, hopefully this is the year.
So have you been playing golf for a long time?
I have, yeah. I've played basically my whole life, tennis mm-hmm. and golf, both since I can remember, maybe 2 years old or 3 years old. So something that I sort of learned growing up and just played a bunch, never taken a lesson or anything like that. So I sort of know why and what my swing does and stuff and why I miss certain things and can sort of correct it. So I don't have many things in my head. It sort of allows me, because I don't play a ton. I probably play maybe 30 rounds a year, and so it sort of helps me not have very many things in my head, and then thus be able to take you know, significant amounts of time off and still come back and be able to play okay. So I just started playing and training, if you will, for Tahoe, you know, a couple weeks out to try and get it going.
Well, I know Jack Nicklaus has been very complimentary about your game. Didn't he say that you are the best golfer he has ever seen who is not a professional golfer?
Non-professional, yeah. That was a pretty fun round of golf that I played with him. And I think in nine holes I made six birdies or something like that, or maybe an eagle and four birdies. I think I shot 30 or 29 maybe or something with him. So it's certainly one of the best stretches of golf I've ever played with the greatest player of all time. So it was pretty fun, pretty good time to do that as well.
Was there any time in your childhood where you thought perhaps you would pursue golf professionally rather than tennis, or were you always going to be a tennis pro?
It's a good question. I mean, it's maybe a question for my dad, because he teaches tennis. He's a teaching pro and been a tennis fan even before I was born. So for him to have a son to play and try to play professional and then end up playing professionally, was certainly special for both of us and him, I'm sure. And, so it was, you know, he sort of pushed me towards tennis a little bit more than golf, even though he loves golf as well. But he's got a special love for the game of tennis that supersedes pretty much almost anything else. And so that was why tennis was sort of in my path.
Sure. Tennis won out when you were younger and throughout your adult life. But I understand you tried to qualify to play in the U.S. Open golf championship.
I have a few times, actually. So it's one of the more fun things to do for me is to play competitive rounds of golf, especially now that I'm retired. I've entered maybe four times. I've done the Monday, the local qualifying is called, and then to try to get into the sectional. I've never made the sectional qualifying, but I've finished as the first alternate. They take five guys in the spot that I usually do it in, and I've finished sixth twice out of the four times. So I was the first alternate, so I ended up going down a couple times to like Newport or something where the sectional qualifying was, but didn't get in.
Right. So what do you think you need to work on to improve to maybe get in? I know there's so much depth out there. There's so many great players. But
everything. Yep, everything. Yeah. There's so many good players. But the enticing part about that U.S. Open qualifying is that it's only 54 holes. It's only basically three rounds of the best rounds of your life. So a round that I played with Mr. Nicklaus, that would have been that certainly would have been one of them, and you need two more, and so it's just pretty enticing. Whereas in tennis, you need to beat, just for someone like me to get into the U.S. Open in tennis, I mean, I need to beat 15 players that are better than me just to get to the main draw. So it's like it's really, really hard to go through local qualifying and pre-qualifying of things in tennis. So in golf, it's pretty amazing where if you have a specific handicap of, I think it's maybe two or less, then you can qualify for the U.S. Open. You can have that dream. And so it's pretty fun. It's certainly fun. It was a bummer they canceled it this year, but understood,
right,
of course.
Sure. But 54 holes, I mean, you just have to really show up every single day. Are you still amazed when you see these pro golfers who can put four rounds, consecutive rounds together and shoot in the 60s, right?
Yeah, I mean they're just so good. That's what they do, and that's it's like any other job, and it's their craft, and so they're the good ones are really. I've been fortunate enough to meet a lot of those guys and become friends with some of the top guys, and it's really fun to play with them and alongside them, sort of pick their brain from time to time.
Does your tennis background, I'm sure it's helped your golf, but is there anything about a tennis swing that you can't bring to the golf course? Like for me, for instance, I'm an amateur tennis player, and I would always lift up, when I'm hitting a topspin forehand or back, I lift up a lot, and that took me so much time to get out of on the golf course, because you just have to plant your feet and stay down, right?
Sure.
Is there anything in tennis for you that you can't bring to the golf course?
For me, it was the backhand. When I was younger, when I was 2 years old, kind of growing up, my backhand is my best shot in tennis, and I'm a lefty in golf, so a righty in tennis, so that's a sort of translate into a a pretty easy low backhand or a golf swing. Same with the baseball swing for me. I'm a lefty baseball swing. I swing lefty, so it's just kind of a natural backhand for me. So those sort of moves have been ingrained in my body, in my brain since I was 2 years old, and come fairly naturally, luckily.
I love it. And you played a lot of tennis growing up and roomed with Andy Roddick. And has he been able to make any breakthroughs on the golf course or no?
He's a great golfer. Yeah.
Andy's
he is.
Got okay.
the bug for sure. The golf bug. He got the golf bug, I want to say maybe 8 to 10 years ago. And he's one of those guys that loves to play. You know, he'll open the top 100 golf courses and he'll want to go and play every one of those. That's kind of the opposite of me. I want to go to just the closest course. I don't really care as long as I'm with good friends and going to have fun. You know, he's in Augusta National and, you know, type Pine Valley and all those special places. I've never played at any of those, nor have any interest really in flying over there to play.
Really?
If it was next door or something. Yeah. I don't
know why. Interest in playing Augusta National?
Not really. No, it's just,
really?
I mean, I would play if I lived in Augusta, but I live in Los Angeles. So,
I guess you're sick of traveling. You travel enough with your tennis career.
Yeah,
right?
I've traveled quite a bit and it's just something that I don't know. I don't know why. It's just something that, I belong to Bel Air Country Club out here in LA and it's, about 2 minutes
place.
Away. Yeah. Yes, exactly. Little Pros still here and still around. And, saw him the other day and he's doing great, but it's about 2 minutes away from my house, so it's hard to go anywhere else.
And so do you take any pride? I'm assuming you beat Andy Roddick on the golf course, is that
ironically we haven't played, and again, like, I've got two young kids and I just don't play as much golf as people think or uh-huh. maybe my game leads out to be. So we haven't played recently in quite a while, to be honest. So, but yeah, I would, you know, if there's no strokes and, you know, no handicaps or anything, yeah, I would fancy myself. And you can tell him that.
I will, because, you know, he got the best of you, you know, once or twice.
Oh, many, many times on the tennis court. But that's over.
I know.
So we don't need to worry about
that. So now it's all about, you know, the golf course. And you mentioned Bel Air. I had the most incredible round at Bel Air. I was able to play with Mac Davis and James Garner.
Wow.
And I'll never forget this because I don't know if James was not used to playing with a woman, but he wasn't playing particularly well when I was playing with them. And he threw his club on the second hole.
Oh, no.
He was so mad at himself. But anyway, it was just an incredible opportunity to play with those
two special guys there. And I never played with James Garner before. But I've played quite a bit with Mac. Know Mac very well.
Please tell him.
There's some really
he's such
cool,
a good guy.
I will. There's some really cool names and people to know in this town at that club, and so it's been a blast to be a member there.
Let's talk a little bit about the U.S. Open Tennis Championships being staged with no spectators. What are your thoughts about that, Marty?
I think it's the right thing to do right now. I certainly feel like there's a way to accomplish the actual event, but certainly not in these times right now with fans, just because it would just be impossible to sort of even get a little bit of amount of people in there. So I think they're doing the right thing. I love that it's going on. You certainly wouldn't want, you know, most other major sports, if not all major sports, going on, and tennis couldn't figure it out. I know it's an incredibly global game, so obviously people coming from tons of different countries and things is makes it challenging. You know, and then sort of trying to keep them in some sort of bubble as well is difficult. Most players have a team alongside them with a physio or a coach, and usually, you know, it's got a wife or a girlfriend or a boyfriend or a husband that's coming with you as well. So I think they're going to try and limit the amount of people on site as well. If I know anything about the USTA, I know they're going to go full bore with it and do everything they can to take care of the players as they always do. And it's an amazing event. It'll be pretty surreal to sort of have the Cincinnati tournament that usually is the week before the U.S. Open in Mason, Ohio, at Flushing Meadows, and in New York the week before the actual U.S. Open goes on. So it's basically a 2 out of 3 set tournament, and then you reshuffle the draw and a 3 out of 5 set tournament. So, it'll be interesting to see how it goes and who plays and who comes along. Some of the top players haven't been super into the idea, and I can understand why people coming from Europe can maybe think about not doing it. But the U.S. Open and USTA specifically they're gonna really take care of the players and make sure that they're safe.
Yeah, Novak Djokovic just tested positive for the coronavirus, and a couple of the guys who played in his charity event tested positive. And then just read where Goran Ivanišević, his coach, tested positive. So how do you think these positive results are going to impact tennis, Marty?
As far as their testing went, I think it was fairly non-existent, which was the issue in Serbia and Croatia, where they went to two different countries, and they didn't have any testing, they didn't have any social distancing whatsoever. They even went out to nightclubs and things during the events to promote the events. I know it was all going to charity, and it was supposed to be a philanthropic thing, but I think they forgot about the safety of everyone involved, which is a bummer, because I do know Novak well, and he's got a good heart, and he wants to, he wanted to help, and they saw something, an idea, and sort of went for it. And obviously, with a couple of the players coming down with it was certainly unfortunate. Look, he's the number one player in the world. And so that's huge news when someone his stature gets the virus, and you sort of wonder how he's going to handle with it. It's going to handle him and how he's going to handle it. But he'll recover fine, I'm sure. And I hope he plays. I hope he plays in the Open, I hope everybody plays. Obviously Roger has come out and said he's not going to play because he's had knee surgery, and he'll be starting in 2021. We don't know if 2021 is going to start. So it's just a really odd time in sports for sure. And specifically tennis.
Yeah, so it'll be interesting to see if Novak Djokovic will come over here. I guess the players who come from Eastern Europe and all over the world have to quarantine over here, Marty, for what, 2 weeks before they can even do anything. So maybe that's that will prevent perhaps a lot of these international players from making the trip. What do you think?
Yeah, there's no doubt. I mean, it's just going to be really difficult for players. I can totally understand coming from, basically anywhere else besides the U.S., where it sounds like, yeah, you have to quarantine for 2 weeks. So that makes the entire trip a 5-week trip instead of a 3.5-week trip or a 5.5-week trip or so. So, which is quite a big difference, when you're leaving your family and sometimes your kids and things. Obviously travel is going to be pretty difficult, to stay healthy. And so you may not want to bring your family, which is, that's a thing as well. But it is a job look, the U.S. Open, if I was still playing in the U.S. Open was in any country, I would certainly be there.
Marty, you're the captain of the U.S. Davis Cup team, and we just heard that the Davis Cup, they're canceling all their matches for this year. How will that affect the team? And I'm sure it's disappointing for you because you love the Davis Cup.
Yeah, it's disappointing and a bummer for sure. It would have still been interesting to see what they were going to do and how they were going to do it. Davis Cup, it comes from the idea of having incredible fans rooting for your country and playing for your country and things. And when they have it would be the equivalent of having a Ryder Cup without fans. And doesn't that seem super strange basically the gist of Ryder Cup and Davis Cup is playing for your country, playing for your nation, playing for your teammates, and then playing for the fans, obviously. And without fans, it would just be a really strange, certainly normal events wouldn't be a big deal, because there's been times over the course of everyone's career where they have, you're playing late at night, or you're playing in hot weather, or super cold or something and there's nobody there or not very many people there, so you can sort of get around that. But as far as Davis Cup and the Ryder Cup and the Fed Cup for the women and obviously the Solheim Cup, it'd be really strange to do it without fans.
Well, I'm wishing you all the best in the American Century Championship.
You need a
first place. You've been second three times. You're going to start being like Phil Mickelson, who's a six-time runner-up at the U.S. Open. So we want a win for Marty Fish and for the tennis world. How about that?
That'd be awesome.
Thank you so much for coming on Talking Golf, and continued success with everything you're doing, Marty.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Sports Interview with Ann Liguori is brought to you by Peak Vision Sunglasses, Zero Distortion, and patented dual zone lens technology. Learn more at Peak Vision, peakvision.com. And Sports Interview with Ann Liguori is brought to you by Dune Jewelry and the new Hamptons Rope Collection. Savor the memories with sand from your favorite beach or golf course in timeless pieces for men and women. That's Dune, D-U-N-E, jewelry.com. Welcome back to Sports Interview with Ann Liguori. My guest, Hale Irwin. And oh my goodness, Hale Irwin has really done it all in his career, from winning 3 U.S. Open titles, 20 PGA Tour victories, 45 Senior Tour wins, 5 Ryder Cups, captain of the first U.S. Presidents Cup team, Hall of Famer, won on 6 continents. I could go on, a most complete and extraordinary career, Hale Irwin. Thanks so much for coming on Sports Interview.
Well, I appreciate you having me, and I look back at these years and what the golf has provided for me, and it's been a great journey. I miss every bit of it.
I'm sure. And, I just went through your list of accomplishments, and, you're really known for those 3 U.S. Open victories. Would you say those 3 U.S. Open victories best defined your career?
Well, it'd be hard to say that they haven't. It certainly has. But I think every professional, when they win their first event, that always is something special, regardless of what it is, because that's what you set out to do. So my first win was extremely satisfying. It got me down that road of success. The first major championship, in my case, I'd always dreamed of a U.S. Open win. And Wingfoot, some 46 years ago, it was awesome. And to follow it up with 2 more, I've just been very grateful with having the opportunity. But my gosh, it's like saying, which of your children do you like the best? It's impossible.
Sure. It's just such great memories. And gosh, 3 U.S. Open wins. That first one, 1974, the massacre at Wingfoot with a score of 7 over par, 287. Tell me about your memories from that U.S. Open.
Well, I think when we all got there, it was, I think we went into shock because the golf course was so difficult. The rough was very long. The conditions under which we had played the previous year's Open were a bit more timid. Johnny Miller had played fantastic round on that last day, and I think the USGA had decided that they had enough of that. We had no weather to speak of, no rain, no wind to speak of that week at Wingfoot. The course was just very hard, and an example, I was speaking with Jeff Ogilvy, who won the 2006 U.S. Open at Wingfoot. He played the last hole with a driver and a 9-iron. And I hit a driver and a 2-iron. Just gives you a little bit of, reference on how technology has changed. Now, Jeff drives the ball longer than I, but still, that a 7-club differential going into that hole is huge, and that's kind of what's happened in the game. Technology is made things so different. So comparing 46 years ago to what's going to be coming up soon is very difficult.
I bet. Boy, that 2-iron came in handy in all 3 of your U.S. Open victories, right?
Oh, yes. It was a handy-dandy tool to have back in the day, and now they don't even make them. We have these hybrid clubs, which are probably a little easier, a little more forgiving, but the 2-iron was, and even the 1-iron, were clubs that we all carried because the ball didn't go real high and you had to hit more of a boring shot. And it's just the way the game was played then.
Doesn't Tiger still carry a 2-iron? He hits that 2-iron stinger.
Well, he can sting just about anything, but Yes, I think any of the clubs, today's 4-iron might have been a 3 or 2-iron in yesteryear, just because the clubs are so much stronger now. So he could take a 3-iron, and it is effectively a 2-iron. He could take a 2-iron, it's effectively a 1-iron. He hits that the stinger, and stingers were hit a long time ago. They just didn't have the panache that the stingers have today.
They didn't quite get quite the attention that they do today with Tiger perfecting that shot. But what about, I heard that you had this dream 3 weeks before you won that 1974 U.S. Open at Wingfoot, that you would really win the championship, and that you only told your wife about it.
Well, that's true, and I didn't want it to sound like, oh, yeah, he's made up a story, but I remember several weeks prior to that, and I don't know, dreams are what they are. You know, you can make into them or out of them, whatever you want to make. But I had thought since I was younger, just learning how to play the game when I was a teenager, that the U.S. Open was something that I looked forward to playing in at some point in time. As an amateur, I could qualify for it to play it. I couldn't play as a professional. So that was an open championship I could play in. And I guess that just manifested itself in some dream that I had won. Now, I didn't win in the same way in the dream that I won, actually, but the end result was the same, that I didn't have that dream. And I told only her, because they didn't want it to just sound like something that wasn't really true.
Well, it's certainly a great omen. Well, of course, Wingfoot has such a rich history in golf. You know, the two layouts were designed by Tillinghast, and they've hosted 5 U.S. Opens and Walker Cup, U.S. Amateur, and a PGA Championship on the West Course. What about this coming U.S. Open? What are your thoughts about Wingfoot hosting the 2020 U.S. Open in September, and how do you think the change from June to September will affect this year's U.S. Open?
Well, I think just from an agronomy perspective, generally speaking, in the earlier summer months or late spring, whatever you want to call it, the grasses are very vibrant. They're growing. They're really catching their stride, and you can have deep rough. You can have greens or fairways or tees that aren't in stress like they might be late in the year, as we are now. So I think it will depend upon the weather. The superintendents now are, oh my gosh, they're so good. They're really doctors of growing things, and they know how to do it and put the right amount of fertilizers and water, and they're so good, and they can keep it playing very nicely. But it's still towards the end of the season. We could see perhaps some wilting of the grasses if it gets a little hot, a little humid, but it certainly wouldn't do that early in the summer. So I think from how it will play, it depends on how the USGA wants it to play. If they want to keep the rough up, they want to keep the water off the course. So that might be a question to ask them. But Wingfoot is just a fabulous golf course. It's not terribly hilly. It's got a few little dips and valleys in it, but it's really not a hilly course. It's pretty straightforward. So there's no excuses to have an uneven lie. You just go out there, and you have to hit it in the fairway, and you have to put it on those rolling greens and stay out of the bunkers and away from missing greens. It's just too hard to get up and down.
And what are the greens like?
Well, they're relatively, I would say relatively large, but they have a lot of contour in them. And that makes them kind of small, in that you have to hit the ball in the general vicinity of the hole. Otherwise, you might have a double or triple breaking putt. They generally would break from back to front, but they all have little false fronts in them. They drop off into deep bunkers on the sides. So I think the greens appear larger than they effectively play, and that's why iron play is so extraordinarily important at Wingfoot.
Sure, I can imagine. I've played it years ago, but not recently, and certainly it's great to get, you know, a champion like yourself's perspective on it, since you played there and won there. And what about the current players? Who do you think of the current talent will perform well at Wingfoot during the U.S. Open?
Well, today's player... The thinking of how to play the game is different than 46 years ago, for instance. You just had to put the ball in the fairway because the ball didn't go as far. We didn't have these prodigious 300-plus, 350-yard drives that these players have today. And as I mentioned earlier, Jeff Ogilvie hitting a 9-iron to the last hole, and I hit a 2-iron. So it's kind of hard to say how they're going to play. The general attitude of today's players seems to be just hit it a long way and then hit it out of the rough with a short iron. Well, back then, you couldn't do that. If you hit it in the rough, you had a long shot and you couldn't get to the green. So it'll depend, I think, on any U.S. Open. You have to put the ball in the fairway. And from there, putting it on in the middle of the green. If I could hit every fairway and hit the middle of every green, I would be very, very happy and take par as a good score on any hole. Today's player, they go flag hunting. They shoot at the pin regardless of how far away they are. I sometimes think that's perhaps a little careless, a little reckless, very aggressive, but that's the way the game is played today.
And with this kind of season that Dustin Johnson's had, you know, the FedEx Cup champ and just the way he's been playing, I can see him, as you say, just bombing it off the tee, keeping it in the fairway, being accurate, and then getting up and down and making those putts, keeping it simple, but, you know, pretty straightforward.
Well, you make a good point. Dustin is probably playing as well as anybody has ever played the game right now, similar to what Brooks Koepka was doing not too long ago. But we have rise and fall of the stars. Rory McIlroy, who was so hot for a while. Jordan Spieth, who was so hot. Now, these guys can still play. Don't get me wrong. They're extremely good players. And so it really kind of depends on that handful of proven players. Dustin certainly is at the top. Rory's there. You can throw in any of these younger players that have won recently. They're sort of playing with no fear. I fear that when you play in the U.S. Open, you better have a little respect because it can bite you very quickly if you get too aggressive, you're going to pay the price.
Absolutely. John Rahm, who won at Muirfield, Olympia Fields, Colin Morikawa.
Yep.
How do you like Colin's game, the PGA champion? I mean,
well,
for such a young man, he's so composed.
He's well beyond his years, is he not? And you make a good point. John Rahm is really coming into his own. He's a big man. He's strong. He hits the ball a long ways. He's got his temperament under control. There's just a handful of guys we could name right off the top that going into the Wingfoot Week have a distinct advantage, not only experience but confidence. But there's always those guys out there that kind of slip under the radar, and sometimes that's the place to be, is playing well, but under the radar, and you fly away from all the interviews, you fly away from all the notoriety, you get in there and you can play your game. And at the end of the week, then you might be the one standing there holding that beautiful trophy.
Hale, what are your thoughts about this abbreviated golf season amidst the pandemic?
Well, gosh, I don't know. It's so hard to say that it's wrong. I think we've endured, and we're still enduring, and we will have to endure even more. I think the USGA and what they've done in golf is probably the right thing, and limiting the exposure that people have when they're flocked together. I know as a PGA Tour player, if you're playing a tournament, you undergo a test every week to see if you're COVID-free, and that's important because it doesn't take too much. The one thing that's really missing, we're seeing some great competition, but we're missing the energy that the galleries bring. The participation of the spectators is so important to the game, and it's almost unheard of right now to not see this exciting play and have the cheers from the galleries rooting the players on. I find it very strange, and I've always tried to feel like you can feed from that. When you're playing well and you get the roar of the crowd, that just energizes you to keep playing better. So it's a little odd.
Yeah, but do you think it might be less pressure for some of these top players not to have the yelling and the screaming and the applauding from the galleries?
Well, it could. It depends on that individual. Certainly it depends on the area. If you're playing in New York where you've got kind of some robust crowds that can get a little bit loud, it may be different than if you were in Birmingham, Alabama, or if you were out in Los Angeles. It doesn't matter. But I think when a player is on his game, you really tune it out. What I found, not only did you get the energy, but you got focus. The people lining the fairways and lining the greens help you focus on your target. Now when you go out there, it's just kind of the green golf course and the bunkers. You have to, I find that's more difficult to find my target and to hit it there than when it's really framed nicely by the people. So, you know, everybody has their own little quirks, I suppose, but that was mine.
That's a good point. Talk about your role with the Keeler 1930, this multi-channel digital platform that is the authoritative tribute and voice of golf's legendary players.
Well, I think it's a platform in which to draw attention to some of the people that have been so instrumental in the game of golf through the years that the audiences out there might not know anything about. Keeler, for instance, was the gentleman that kind of brought together Augusta National with all the beginnings of that in the Masters with Clifford Roberts and Bobby Jones. He brought that together. And there are writers, there are players, there are people in the game that have been so important to the game of golf, and that's what this platform will do. It'll bring those people to the fore, and those listening and find it on the website have a whole new, almost an encyclopedia, if you wish, although we don't have those anymore, but a library from which they can choose to find out more about the game of golf and the people in it.
What a great idea, a new chapter in the story of golf. And, you know, when you talk about Keeler, he was an Atlanta sports writer who apparently gained fame by covering Bobby Jones. And Bobby Jones used to say he was the greatest sports writer who ever lived. So I want to find out more about this guy, Keeler.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting story when you go back and see the origins of not only the Masters and Augusta National, but the key people in it. Keeler was one of them, and Jones was one of them, and those people were brought together, and they created the dynamics, which is now the Masters Tournament. But it goes beyond that, far beyond that. That's just one example.
What are you doing these days, Hale Irwin?
Trying to stay out of trouble. well, I'm not playing like I used to, because, well, this year for sure with COVID, but I'm several years ago I had a bit of a foot problem, and that kind of put a real wrench in my golf swing, and where I can still hit the ball, I've lost some distance. And not only that, but at my age, it's kind of hard to keep up, and priorities change as you get older. I don't have perhaps the stamina. I don't have the focus to get out there and do what I used to do with regularity. There's just some other things that have crept into my life that are more important, and that's like living a life and not always being on the road and not always being out there competing. It's enjoying my family, my grandchildren, and doing the things that I've put off for so long. It's time to do now. So I'm enjoying it. I can tune in and watch a golf tournament now and enjoy it rather than look at it and growl and kick the ground and think, why am I not there? He could have done that, or why did he do this? No, I can look at it now and enjoy it.
Well, I'm sure you can look back on your career and be completely satisfied and fulfilled, because what a complete, extraordinary career it was. Hale Irwin, thank you so much for joining me on Sports Interview.
Thank you, Ann. It's been a pleasure.
My thanks to Marty Fish, to Hale Irwin, and to Kyle Lynch in the studio. Have a wonderful weekend, everybody. Be safe, enjoy your sports, and I'll talk to you next Saturday morning right here from 7 to 8 on Sports Interview with Ann Liguori.